This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Before we get started with today's show, I'd like to let you know that this will be the last Down East Journal episode heard on Public Radio East for a while. We will be suspending production of the show. We'll be sharing more details about that decision and plans for the future later on Down East Journal today. Over the years, we've brought you stories from 30,000 feet.
All right, here we go.
I love my job.
To 30 miles off our coast.
My deepest depth today was 126 feet.
So for our last show, we thought it would be fitting to showcase some of the stories we've covered during our 12-year run. Last summer, I took a road trip around eastern North Carolina in search of barbecue. Not just any barbecue, eastern North Carolina whole hog wood-smoked barbecue. And of course, that tangy, spicy, vinegar-based sauce that's instantly recognized as our spin on barbecue. My first stop, Bee's Barbecue, on the outskirts of Greenville. It's on NC-43, across from a cornfield. The nondescript brick building with a weathered white facade and faded blue awning has a blue Pepsi-Cola sign emblazoned with Bee's Barbecue, born in eastern North Carolina. It would be easy to drive right by, except for the stream of traffic turning off the highway. Cars line both sides of the street, and parking is hard to find. It's the lunchtime rush, and Bee's Barbecue is bustling.
It seemed like it's the flavor that I grew up on, home cooked.
Felicia Boddy has been coming to Bee's for years. Today she's brought along her sister, Beverly Johnson.
It's your first time coming
here? First time. I just moved here from Maryland.
What have you heard about Bee's Barbecue?
It's the best. It must be the best. They have a road named after it.
Felicia and Beverly join the mob of people standing at the sliding glass window carved into the side of the building where orders are placed if you're going to be eating outside. There's also seating indoors. It's a no-frills eating establishment that sticks with tradition. Whole hog, wood-smoked, and vinegar sauce. That keeps customers like Eugene Richardson coming back for more.
Best, hands down, in North Carolina. Yes, we made the trip over here just to eat here today.
Is it always like this?
Always. They only open, they're going to sell what they already cooked, and then they're closing for the day. The guy told me, said they won't be much longer. They're going to sell out real soon.
And that's the way it works at Bee's Barbecue. First come, first served.
Yeah, barbecue sandwich and half a order of corn steaks.
About a dozen people are camped out at picnic tables in the shade of a large oak devouring barbecue. I find a place at a picnic table across from John Radford of Pactolus. He's been coming to Bee's Barbecue since they opened in the late 1970s.
I came here when it was just a country store. I used to walk over here. I lived down the road and watched the snakes crawl across the creek down here before I got here.
Bee's Barbecue has been serving Pitt County and the surrounding area for more than 40 years, and now the joint is experiencing even more recognition as a nominee for the best barbecue sandwich in North Carolina. It's also a stop on the North Carolina Historic Barbecue Trail, which features 23 barbecue pits across the states. My next stop is about a half hour away in the town of Aden. It's hard to miss the Skylight Inn between the large billboard in front and a replica of the Capitol building's rotunda on top of the restaurant. Manager and co-owner of Skylight Inn, Sam Jones, says the restaurant was opened by his grandfather, Pete Jones, in 1947.
At that time, him and my dad had this idea that, hey, these folks said that this was the best barbecue in America, and we're going to, pun intended, capitalize on that.
The Skylight Inn started as Pete Jones Barbecue, a small building with no air conditioning serving hamburgers, hot dogs, and beer. But Jones says Eastern North Carolina barbecue was always a part of his family legacy.
Probably the 60s was when it transitioned to only doing whole hog barbecue, and that was it, exclusive pork. And had always served barbecue. Several generations back in our family had barbecue joints.
Now, Sam carries on the tradition of slow-cooked, whole-hog, wood-smoked barbecue.
It starts with fresh meat, building a fire. This chimney that we're standing in front of right now is causing us to sweat.
Yeah.
that is the heat source that fuels our fires, literally. And so our meat's put on mid-afternoon, and it's cooked all night. And so that's a 18-hour process for you to be able to hold a pork sandwich in your hand.
It's about 1:30 now, but people are still coming and going. Beverly Johnson is originally from Kinston, but now lives in Norfolk, Virginia. She comes to Skylight Inn every couple of months to get a taste of home.
Well, I think I've converted quite a few Virginians to what real barbecue is now. So whenever I come home, they say, hey, are you going to stop and bring some of that good barbecue back? So, yeah.
You're a barbecue evangelist.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And a snob.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Barbecue enthusiast Jack Macy is in the parking lot snapping a photo of the Skylight Inn's rotunda. It's his first stop on the North Carolina Historic Barbecue Trail.
Oh, I ate just a little bit ago.
Oh, did you? Tell me about it.
It was real good. Got real good smoke flavor. Got a real good pork flavor. Got some of the skin in there, a little crunchy skin.
Inside the Skylight Inn, a line meanders around tables from the order counter to the back of the restaurant. A worker wielding two meat cleavers chops the barbecue as other workers busily pack barbecue into red and white checkered serving trays, add a slice of cornbread, and top it off with a heap of coleslaw.
I think some people in Eastern North Carolina take it for granted, but we're spoiled to an extent, because at one time there was tons of barbecue places that cooked whole hog barbecue over wood, and as time continues to go on, it seems like that population's shrinking.
For some, it's the sauce. For others, it's about texture. And there seems to be as many different ways to prepare barbecue as there are loyal fans who are willing to indulge in the Eastern North Carolina delicacy and help keep the tradition alive. If you want to explore Eastern North Carolina and visit some of the locations on the historic barbecue trail, which also includes stops at Wilbur's Barbecue in Goldsboro and Grady's Barbecue in Dudley, go to ncbbqsociety.com. This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. We dug into the archives this week and found a feature from the very first episode of Down East Journal, which aired on October 1st, 2004. North Carolina was in the midst of an active hurricane season. Hurricane Charley came ashore in mid-August, just south of the state's border with South Carolina, and remnants of Hurricane Francis and Ivan made their way to the western part of the state. The entirety of that first show was focused on the then-current hurricane season, though one piece looked back to the hurricane season of a much earlier time that proved the death knell of one Down East community. George Olson reported on that event in the first Down East Journal, which aired October 1st, 2004.
Each hurricane that has hit North Carolina's coast has left its unique imprint, though enough time and enough hurricanes pass and cycles start to repeat themselves.
And the storm of 1896 was a precursor of the storm of 1899. It came in almost the same direction and in almost the same magnitude. And the storm of 1899 was made all the more damaging because it followed so closely from the storm of 1896. Now, 100 years later, we had Hurricane Fran and Bertha in 1996. Then we had Dennis, and Floyd in 1999. So at the end of the 20th century, we had basically the same weather pattern of storms as we had at the end of the 19th century.
Joel Hancock is the author of Strengthened by the Storm, an account of the Mormon Church on Harker's Island, which contains an account of those 1896 and 1899 storms. The effects of the 1999 hurricanes are still being felt, with individual families still seeking to regain their footing. But communities survived. Princeville, for example, found the dam they built to keep floodwaters out kept them in following Floyd, but rather than move to higher ground, they chose to rebuild the dam even taller than before. 100 years earlier, not all communities survived.
Now you can still go to Diamond City. I could take you there today, and you could see where houses were because there was a distinguishing physical characteristic. They would gather shells, I'm sure the same shells that they had eaten from, scallops, oysters, and clams, and put them under the house to keep the wind from blowing underneath. And now wherever you see those piles of shells, you know that's where a house used to be.
During the latter part of the 19th century, Diamond City was the most populated village on the entire Outer Banks. Situated on the eastern end of Shackelford Banks, a distinct topographical feature aided the comfort and livelihood of its residents and offered protection from the vagaries of coastal weather. Joel Hancock reads from Strengthened by the Storm.
The most distinguishing feature of the area, aside from its proximity to the sea, was a large sand dune that sat near the geographic center of the community. It was called the Yellow Hill and was said to have been 1,200 feet long, over 400 feet wide, and reached a peak of at least 40 feet in height. The hill served as a windbreak of sorts and provided some relief from the seemingly perpetual sou'westers that blew in off the Atlantic.
The Yellow Hill also allowed a vantage point for Diamond City's main source of hard currency, shore-based whaling.
They would stand on the high hills, such as the Yellow Hill that I've mentioned before. They could actually see the spite of the whales offshore, and then they would head off in a dory. They would harpoon the whale and latch to it and just wait till the whale died. And then they would pull it ashore and then harvest it. They would sell the oil and the blubber.
The Yellow Hill also protected the islanders' vegetable crops from incessant winds. The vegetables, combined with the currency from the whaling industry and fishing for shellfish or bottomfish, provided Diamond City's residents a good subsistence living. But petroleum was overtaking whale oil as a source of fuel, damaging the shore-based whaling community, and before the storms of 1896 and 1899 hit, the population among all the communities of Shackelford Banks had dwindled from around 800 to closer to 500. The storm sped the wasting of the communities along. Joel Hancock again reads from Strengthened by the Storm.
That August brought a storm to which all subsequent storms would be compared for more than a generation. Throughout Carteret County, havoc and destruction were left in its path. In the small community of Witt, or sea level, alone, 7 lives were lost. Yet nowhere in Carteret County was the damage of greater eventual consequence than at Diamond City and Shackelford Banks. There, the wind and tides of the South Atlantic left more than battered buildings as their legacy. Rather, they rang a death knell for the several communities that had grown and flourished on what had been a comfortable and hospitable island. More than half a century later, the few remaining survivors of the storm would describe it as vividly as if it had occurred the previous evening, and I quote, "The wind blew from the northeast at first and brought in tides from the sound," one explained to Lee and Davis. "And then, following hours of that, all was perfectly calm for a short while. Suddenly, the wind shifted to the southwest and again blew as hard or harder than before. With the southwest winds came the water from the ocean, and the two waters met. This time, few, if any, homes were without water in them. Even the giant sand dune that ran through the center of town had been almost washed away by the storm. To add insult to the already intolerable injury, the ransacked waters had uncovered graves in the local cemetery and left bones and caskets strewn everywhere."
The retreat from Diamond City was swift. Less than 2 years after the 1899 storm, a written history by the Mormon missionaries who visited the island revealed little there.
In June of 1901, he says, "So widespread had been the exodus from the banks that they could find only a little flock of houses among the sandhills."
The missionaries would have found those people not far away. Some moved to the mainland, to Marshallburg or Morehead City. Some squatted on land at Bogue Banks, owned by the Theodore Roosevelt family, who eventually gave them squatters' rights. Most, however, didn't stray far from their former community.
But the main group of them, about 60 to 75%, were willing to move, but were not willing to move too far. And so they just moved across Back Sound to Harker's Island, which was largely uninhabited but protected from the ocean waves by Shackford Banks and Core Banks. And so they moved this way. They dismantled their houses and put them on dories or boats, moved them across the sound, and then reassembled them. Except for some of them, their houses were so small, they just hoisted up their houses as best they could, put them on a boat, and moved the whole house across to Harker's Island, and then reassembled it on the south shore of Harker's Island. And there they remain for almost a century.
Some of those houses remain on Harker's Island, though Hancock says they've been enveloped by new construction over the years. Though the houses survive, Diamond City did not following the storms. But in some odd way, though the hurricanes forced Diamond City's families to scatter by 1901, the hurricanes didn't succeed in tearing a community apart. In some way, it brought it closer together.
They moved as families. Perhaps for some of them, they may have been even closer. The Willises may have been at 3 different places on Diamond City, but they all moved to Red Hill on Harker's Island. The Hancocks may have been at several different places, but they all moved to the same place on Harker's Island. And so, for anything, it was a convenient sorting and rearranging of things.
Joel Hancock is a Harker's Island resident, the grandson of one of the last men to leave Diamond City, and the author of Strengthened by the Storm, The Early Mormons of Harker's Island. I'm George Olson.
This is the Down East Journal. Harkers Island and other communities in downeast Carteret County, like Atlantic and Sea Level, are the only place where the centuries-old Hoitoi dialect and vocabulary is still used today, but it's slowly disappearing. In this feature from March 2010, we learn about efforts to preserve the Carolina brogue.
What is a dingbatter?
You're really not a bad person, but just an outsider that comes in and ask you where the lighthouse is, or when he's standing right in front of it, or ask you, point out over the Pamlico sign and say, is this the Atlantic Ocean?
Even though they may be hard to understand, residents on the Outer Banks of North Carolina have been speaking with what's called the brogue for centuries. The early residents of Carteret and Dare counties came south by boat from Tidewater, Virginia, and the eastern shores of Maryland and set up small fishing communities. Originally, many of them came from southwest England or the Ulster province of Ireland. Lori Strebel is the public programs director for the North Carolina Maritime Museum.
Harkers Islanders are originally settlers of Shackelford Banks. In Shackelford Banks, they moved over to Harkers Island, to Morehead City, to the other local coastal areas. Oak Cokers are also originally from the same place that Shackelford, way back, several hundreds of years ago, to Ireland and England. Those people from Ireland and England moved down to these regions in the early 1700s, around 1715.
Residents of Ocracoke and Harkers Island speak with what's called the Hoitoi dialect. Basically, a long I sound becomes an oi.
So high tide on the sound side, the way it sounds, would be to an Ocracoker, Hoitoi on the same side. Gets a little bit confusing. But yeah, Hoitoi on the swan side.
Changing the I to oi isn't as unique as some of the other features of the dialect. Walt Wolfram is the William C. Friday Distinguished Professor of English Linguistics at NC State University.
The way they pronounce sound as sane, or brown as brain, so that it almost, brown almost sounds like brain, that particular pronunciation is only found on the coasts of North Carolina. So that's a very unique pronunciation, and this is the only regional area where it is actually found.
Along with traditions and dialect, the Outer Bankers developed their own words. Some of the words would vary from location to location. For instance, Ocracokers would say the word dingbatter to describe someone who's an outsider. On Harkers Island, the term dit-dot would be used.
Me honky is one of the silliest words I've ever heard. That's a game of hide and seek where children will honk at each other to give up their location. That's only used out at Ocracoke. Pizer is one that's used commonly all around Carteret or Carteret for those of you local speakers county. Pizer is a porch. Quamish means an upset stomach. You hear mommick a whole bunch. A flagget is a little piece of something. Slick cam is very still water, and a puck is a sweetheart, somebody that would be your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your crush would be a puck.
In addition to words, Outer Bankers developed their own grammatical style.
For example, the use of weren't for negatives, as in I weren't there, it weren't there, and so forth, only on the coast of North Carolina and Virginia and Maryland is this grammatical form found in the United States.
Though these villages remain relatively isolated for a couple hundred years, the Outer Banks is now one of the most popular travel destinations in the world and receives millions of visitors annually. Increased contact with outsiders has brought rapid change, and today locals are striving to hang on to their heritage, traditions, and dialect. The North Carolina Life and Language Project was established at North Carolina State University in 1993 to document and preserve the dialects from different regions of the state, including the Southern Highlands, Piedmont, Virginia Piedmont, Coastal Plain, and Outer Banks region. NC State English Linguistics Professor Walt Wolfram is the director of the project.
You have grandparents who have a very strong version of the brogue. You have middle-aged people who may or may not have it, depending on where they situate themselves culturally in terms of identity and so forth. And then you have the younger generation, where those who may have the brogue are almost seen as an exception and an oddity. So, I mean, in that sense, it's a classic sort of three-generation cycle where you lose a language within three generations.
Today, Harkers Island is home to about 500 ancestral islanders, residents whose parents are either from Harkers Island or the neighboring Shackelford Banks, and who have lived on the island for most of their lives.
This is the Downeast Journal. Nearly 100 years ago, residents of Currituck County rallied to build a school for the underserved African-American population. Now, a century later, residents in the same community are rallying yet again to save the dilapidated structure from destruction. Chris Thomas has more on the Coin Jaw Colored School in this feature, heard in April 2016.
How do you make the best out of a bad situation? In the old Coin Jaw Colored Schools case, the answer seems to be, move it about a mile down the road.
Man, let me tell you, you want to talk about some remarkable engineering and some really, really fascinating thing to see.
Paul Robinson, owner of the Currituck Barbecue Company in Barco, one of the county's many unincorporated communities.
I mean, they take a building that's 80 feet long and 30 feet wide, and they run steel beams underneath it, and that thing just lifts up like it's nothing. And then they hook it to a big old truck and haul her out of there. And it was really, really remarkable and something to see.
The building now rests behind his restaurant. In his commute to work each day, he passed an old, abandoned building with a weathered facade. Its story was unknown or forgotten to many, but remembered by some. In 2002, the National Trust listed Rosenwald Schools among the 11 most endangered historic buildings in the country.
One day when I drove past, I saw Barbara Snowden, who's kind of a local historian, and she was out poking around that house. And so the next time she was in the restaurant, I asked her, you know, kind of what the deal with it was, because, you know, I was kind of interested in it. And she told me the backstory, how it was a Rosenwald school.
The Coin Jaw Colored School is one of nearly 5,000 built across the South and Midwest between the late 1910s and the early 1930s. They were funded, in part, by Julius Rosenwald, who helped turn Sears, Roebuck & Company into the titan it became. Among the states served by Rosenwald schools, North Carolina was the most active. According to the State Historic Preservation Office, more than 800 were built in North Carolina, many of which were in eastern counties, including Duplin, Edgecombe, Pitt, and Currituck.
So education has always been something that's very, very valued here.
Barbara Snowden is president of the Currituck County Historical Society. She first became interested in 2011 after she became aware the school was in danger of destruction. As Sears and Rosenwald's stock rose, the fortunes of black Americans plummeted, especially in the rural South. According to History South, a website founded by Charlotte-based historian Tom Hanchette, the government spent about $5 less on average for black students than white students in 1915. With the help of public education and racial justice advocates, including Tuskegee Institute founder Booker T. Washington, Rosenwald started a fund to help address the education deficit among black children in some of the country's poorest areas. But, as Snowden explains, these projects were a joint venture between the philanthropist and the communities.
The one that was built in Coin Jaw was built in Coin Jaw. It was paid for by Mr. Rosenwald, by the black community, by the school board here in Currituck, and then by public donations. Mr. Rosenwald would not build a school unless it could be proven that there was community support. And so that building shows the community support of schools here in Currituck.
Between 1920 and 1950, the building, with its wooden exterior, asphalt roof, and two classrooms, not only served as a schoolhouse, but as a meeting place for the Coin Jaw community. But by the end of World War II, black schools in Currituck County, including Coin Jaw's, were in dreadful condition. The county built a new school for all black students, and soon after that, the former Coin Jaw Colored School was sold and turned into a private residence. As time passed, the building became dilapidated and a public eyesore. There were plans to demolish it. This didn't sit well with Snowden.
It bothers me that people do not know their own history of the area. And I understand the other side is we are a gateway to Dare County, and all the tourists are going to go by and see these buildings. And the Carter does need to look nice, but you don't need to destroy your heritage, your resources.
Originally, according to the State Historic Preservation Office's report, it only took about $4,000 to build the school, which opened in the autumn of 1920. Nearly 100 years later, Robinson bought the property for only $1,000 more. The building is an example of North Carolina's mixed history on race and education. Though segregation remained the law of the state for another 40 years, it took contributions from white residents and the Currituck County government, along with the local black community, to make the school a reality. The Coin Jaw Colored School, and the remaining Rosenwald schools across North Carolina are tangible reminders of the state that straddled the fence between keeping the races separate, and often unequal, while taking relatively proactive measures to make sure all of its citizens had access to an education. If you want to find out more about North Carolina's Rosenwald schools, visit the State Historic Preservation Office's website at hpo.ncdcr.gov. I'm Chris Thomas.
Today we've been listening to some highlights from more than 12 years of Downey's Journal and hearing some of my favorites. As announced earlier in the show, Public Radio East has decided to suspend production of the Downey's Journal. But don't worry, you'll still be hearing my features and interviews on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I want to assure you, this change will allow for us to focus on producing more local content, bringing you stories of local interest, and keeping you informed of what's happening here in Eastern North Carolina. To everyone who has listened and supported Downey's Journal over the years, thank you so much.